Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Not that anyone asked, but in case anyone was wondering about my religious status, I'm a very recent Catholic convert. There's a story behind that that I could go on about for a while, but the only part that's relevant to today's episode is the fact that I was actually raised Baptist in the Bible Belt of the South, Little Rock, Arkansas to be exact. But at the age of 20, I left Arkansas for California, and for the next few decades, most of my religious upbringing simply fell by the wayside. I never called myself an atheist, but for far too much of that time frame, I pretty much lived as if I were one. Fortunately, God had the love, the patience, the mercy, and the forgiveness to help me find my way out of that aimless, godless way of life and to put my feet on the right path and to surround me with good people. The reason I bring this up is I have a friend who, for various reasons, recently went from being a fairly devout Catholic to rejecting his faith and swinging hard in the opposite direction. He made a kind of a deep dive into all the atheistic counter-arguments against Christianity, and he bought them all more or less hook, line, and sinker. I've been thinking about what I can do to break through this shell he has constructed around himself, but honestly, right now I think he is too militant and defensive in his newfound unbelief for me to do that. So I'm going to give him a little time to see if he comes to his senses, or at the very least lets his guard down, and then I'll have a conversation with him. But being the book nerd that I am, in addition to that, I'm also considering sending him a book I think would help dismantle all the atheistic talking points he absorbed. It's a book by the well-known Christian writer Eric Metaxas, who has actually been a guest on this podcast, and the book is called simply, Is Atheism Dead?, which overwhelmingly demonstrates that the idea today of a creatorless creation is logically untenable. Metaxas marshals a ton of scientific, archaeological, and historical evidence for the existence of God and then utterly demolishes atheism in a page-turning, irrefutable, airtight case. Maybe it might help my friend begin to reject the false arguments of atheism and find his way back to his faith. But I just finished a new book by the controversial scholar Charles Murray, which I think might make an even better recommendation for someone like my friend. It's called Taking Religion Seriously, and it is a very personal account by Murray of how he went from unthinkingly, uncritically accepting the secular worldview in which he was immersed as a scholar and an intellectual, to being curious enough to investigate some of the serious claims Christianity makes. Murray takes you on this journey in the book, in a very concise, thought-provoking work, which seems all the more legitimate because Murray still has doubts. He's not completely made that leap from self-described, over-educated agnostic to full-on believer. He is a man who, as he readily admits himself, relies too much on reason and empirical evidence and lacks the what he calls the perceptual ability to come to belief through a spiritual pathway. So I think Charles Murray is in the same boat as maybe millions of other Americans, my friend possibly being one of them, people who need a sort of evidential breakthrough to open their minds to the existence of God. And as fate would have it, Charles Murray happens to be my guest today at the Right Take Podcast. So stay tuned, you don't want to miss this conversation, and don't forget to subscribe to the Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a Harvard and MIT-educated policy analyst. He's the Hayek Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of The Bell Curve, about IQ, Coming Apart, about the class divide in America, and a sweeping study of human accomplishment called, oddly enough, Human Accomplishment, among many other books. It seems like everything he writes triggers angry ideologues, which suggests to me that his work is right over the target. In any case, he's also the author of a very different kind of book, which we're going to get into today, called Taking Religion Seriously. Charles Murray, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
It's an honor to have you on, Dr. Murray. I'd like to ask you questions about all your books because there's so much fascinating material to dive into, but I'm very excited actually about your newest book, which clocks in at only about 150 or 160 pages, but it's so dense with ideas and insights, and I think it's an important book. In it, you trace what you call your meandering pilgrimage to belief, from a self-described overeducated agnostic to, while maybe not fully embracing Christianity, nonetheless acknowledging that you now have an openness to embracing Christianity. And that's a faith that previously you would have simply dismissed as irrelevant in the modern world, isn't it?
That's correct. I maybe eccentric Christian is is as good a description as any.
Well, this book is quite a departure for you. It's very personal, and yet I think it speaks to countless and possibly millions of people who are in the same boat that you began in, and that is people whose, shall we say, over-reliance on reason and empirical evidence prevent them from making the leap of faith that a lot of other people are capable of.
Yes, it's precisely that which motivated me to write the book. It was actually suggested to me by a colleague of mine at AEI, a man named Nick Eberstadt, one of America's most insightful demographers and economists, who himself is a devout Roman Catholic. And hearing me describe my eccentric Christianity, yeah, he said, "Oh, your next book ought to be that." And as soon as he said that, I realized that I am absolutely a role model for, yes, tens of millions of people who are, their characteristics are, first, they're likely to be highly educated or overeducated, and they also are not militant atheists,
yeah,
but religion just hasn't been a big deal for them. And it's been kind of irrelevant. And in the first of several times, I will probably quote my wife. I will quote her first by saying what she found when she went to college, which is, quote, "Smart people don't believe that stuff anymore."
Yeah.
And that's what I learned when I got to Harvard. It was just simply in the air. It was part of the zeitgeist. And I was also unthinkingly a child of the Enlightenment. So, for example, I was a materialist, even though I didn't use that terminology, in my view of consciousness. That is, I assumed that consciousness resides exclusively in the brain, mm-hmm, and therefore, when death occurs, consciousness ceases. Therefore, there is no life after death. Therefore, all the major religions of the world are wrong. And this was all very unreflective. I was just treating it as self-evident. And what really happened to me was a long process whereby nudges and occasionally a whack upside the head moved me off that unreflective acceptance of smart people don't believe that stuff anymore.
What were the philosophical or scientific assumptions that you held, what you call in the book your secular catechism? Well, I guess you've already touched on it some, that initially distanced you from religious belief. And also it was your wife, actually, who kickstarted the erosion of those assumptions,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, the part of the catechism I haven't mentioned was, and I think this has to occur to all people when they think about religion in the 21st century, or for that matter, the 20th century, we are on an obscure, nondescript planet in an obscure galaxy in a universe with literally billions of galaxies. How in that situation can we be anything more meaningful than fly specks? And so the idea of a personal God, and even of a God itself, is ridiculous. And I mentioned the other part about consciousness. And then the third part of the catechism was that, well, why do religions arise? They arise because people are scared of death.
Yeah.
And that's why. And they're trying to come up with something that'll rationalize what away that fear of death. And for that matter, up until very recently, the Earth was such a mysterious place with earthquakes and thunderstorms and all sorts of other natural phenomena that the belief in the supernatural was understandable. So that was all part of the unthinking catechism, and my wife's name is Catherine. She is the one who kickstarted it, and the story is worth recounting. She, like me, had exactly the same attitude toward religion I did. We both had grown up as Protestants in a small town in Iowa. We both had put all of that aside. And then Catherine had our first child in 1985. And after a couple of months, she told me that she loved Anna so much that it was hard to tell where she stopped and Anna began. And then she came up with another one of these lines, another one. This one became used by both Michael Gerson and David Brooks publicly. And the line was this: "I love Anna far more than evolution requires." Now, that's what happens when you have an Oxford and Yale trained wife. She knows all about evolution. You know, she's no dummy. And in fact, her intellectual hero was Huxley. It was Huxley who coined the word agnostic. Anyway, she knows about evolution, but she felt she was a conduit for a much deeper love that came from somewhere else.
Yes.
And so that was enough to set her off on the journey that she took. She couldn't go to a conventional church and recite the Nicene Creed in good conscience. And so she ended up in Quakerism. But she ended up in spiritual Quakerism as opposed to social activist Quakerism. And I wished her well and all that and took care of our little baby while she went to Quaker meeting. Mm-hmm. And for about 10 years, didn't pay too much attention to it. But during that period of time, I developed an insight which I think is true and more people should understand. And that is, spiritual perceptiveness is akin to other human traits, such as the ability to enter fully into music, which some people have and some people don't, mm-hmm. the ability to enter into the visual arts, which some people have and some people don't. And this is a perceptual ability, which if you don't have it, makes you think that people who are deeply spiritual are making it up, or they are deluding themselves. In my case, I did not have that option. My wife has an extraordinary intellect. That is not a fond husband speaking. That is a guy who knows a hell of a lot about IQ speaking, that she has an extraordinary intellect. She is extremely realistic about herself and about the rest of the world, and she was not deluding herself in any way. And I find I had to accept, from both watching her and people that I met through her, that I am somewhere at the left side of the bell curve of spiritual perceptiveness. I have the IQ equivalent of about 70 when it comes to spiritual perception. And so I was unable to follow her. But I was so convinced that she was into something real and important that I started to use the things I am good at to examine empirically a lot of the elements of my secular catechism that formerly I never really thought about.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it takes a lot of humility to recognize that you might be wrong about something as profound as religious faith and to be open-minded enough to start challenging your own belief system. So kudos to you for that, because humility of that sort, especially in what I'll call the intellectual class, is in short supply. Why Christianity? How did working on your book, Human Accomplishment, sort of lay the groundwork for your appreciation of Christianity?
I was working on Human Accomplishment from about 1997 to 2003. It took longer than any other book I've written. And among other things, I came to accept that Christianity had played a huge role in the development of Western civilization. Initially, I had thought that a lot of the groundwork was laid by the Greeks, especially Aristotle, who remains one of my favorites, and Plato. and that in the individualism that was so important to the development of Western civilization had been established then, and so had come. They came within an inch of discovering the scientific method. And then, as I learned more about 1500 to 1900 and the role that Christianity played in the arts especially, it seemed to me that the deterioration of the arts in the late 1900s and the 20th century, whether it's literature or the visual arts or music, was obvious, that the quality of work went off the edge of a cliff. And that's something that someone like Jacques Barzun, I think, documents very thoroughly in From Dawn to Decadence.
Yes.
But it also just reflected my own feelings that atonal music is unlistenable, mm-hmm. let alone John Cage, that Andy Warhol's soup cans bear no comparison with Raphael or Titian. And that modern novels, postmodern novels, are lifeless.
Yes.
And why did that happen? Why this nihilism? Why this self-absorption of the artist into what they wanted to do? I think it related to their secularization during that same period. That artists until then, in all the arts, had grown up in an environment saturated with the notions of the true, the good, and the beautiful. And their work, in some way, had to be motivated by that. And as early as 2003, when I was concluding Human Accomplishment, I have a paragraph in there saying that we have to contemplate the role of the transcendent in creating great art, and specifically religion. And I had the line, Johann Sebastian Bach does not have to explain himself. You know, he and the other devout Christians had a way of looking at the world which was enabling them, facilitating them in doing their magnificent work. Yes. And then I also discovered right at the end of working on Human Accomplishment, a book by Rodney Stark called For the Glory of God.
Yes.
Stark himself at that time was still an agnostic, although sympathetic to Christianity, but mm-hmm. his book is about Christianity, and he has a very convincing case that not only was the Catholic Church not the antagonist of science, that in many ways the Roman Catholic Church underwrote the development of the scientific method and applauded, especially through St. Thomas Aquinas, the discovery of the way that the universe works. And so I was already inclined at that point to say that Christianity deserved a lot of respect than I had given it. And then in 2005, a friend introduced me to C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity.
Yes.
And I am one of how many thousands of people or tens of thousands of people who that book,
yeah,
it opened up the importance of taking religion seriously and specifically taking Christianity seriously. For listeners who have never encountered Mere Christianity, let me assure you that what you will understand 20 pages in is that there is at least one really smart guy who still believes that stuff, and that was C.S. Yes. Lewis, who's a brilliant man, brilliant arguments. And even when you disagree with him, you are obligated not just to say, well, I don't buy it. He has challenged you to say, well, I gotta figure out why I don't buy it. And that then drives you deeper and deeper, or at least it drove me deeper and deeper, into questions of the historicity of the Bible, the New Testament especially, and the ability to interpret what the New Testament says as something other than fairy stories.
Yes. Well, throughout the book, you reference thinkers like theologians Thomas Aquinas and C.S. Lewis, as you mentioned, as guides in your conversion. What are a couple of ideas, a couple of their ideas that challenged your skepticism?
One of the first ones comes out of the opening chapters of Mere Christianity, and that is Lewis's argument for the existence of a moral law.
Yes.
A moral law that is embedded in human beings. And I'm not doing justice to his argument in this brief summary of it,
sure.
But he's saying, no, I understand evolution, and I'm saying that there is something going on here that is not explained by evolutionary selection pressures. And he makes a good case for that. And then he, after you've been reading this for three or four chapters, he draws it all together, and then he makes the statement where you gulp and say, can I buy into this? And the statement is that if God were trying to reveal himself to us, he can no more do it than an architect can reveal himself in the wall of a building he designed. Mm-hmm. It would have to be by prompting us in some way to behave in certain ways. And that is what the moral law amounts to. It amounts to a revelation of God, and God is, I'm simplifying here, God is love.
Yes.
But love meaning agape, and the Greek word which refers to a kind of selfless love of others and a broader love. It's a love that's very difficult to pin down in words. Well, saying you believe in that is opening up the possibility of believing in a personal God. And the fact that you are forced to consider that seriously was a major step forward for me. The second thing that I challenged was the comforting story that the revisionists tell about the New Testament. That comforting story, by revisionists, I group two centuries of a tradition of different traditions of the start in the early 19th century in Germany and then continue up through the Jesus seminar that most recently. Anyway, the short version of that is that the New Testament is basically a confection. A confection of stories that may have originally had their origins during Jesus's life, but have been subsequently so altered by retellings and redactions, augmentations, that it's very difficult to say that anything in the New Testament is grounded in historical reality. And I kept running into, well, I started out by running into a book titled Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by an English theologian named Richard Baucom. And he made the argument, which he said was very unfashionable, and indeed it still was at that time, it made the argument that the New Testament actually goes to great lengths to make the point that it's being reported by eyewitnesses to the events, and that there is embedded in the New Testament a lot of material that supports the proposition that we are reading the witness of eyewitness testimony. And then subsequently, I discovered that Baucom was not as lonely a voice as I thought he was. There were other very able people who were making that same case, and they were making it with some pretty darn good empirical observations. So the combination of those two things meant that I had to take the whole New Testament up to and including the resurrection very seriously.
And not just the Gospels themselves, but other artifacts, as we'll say, as evidence for the existence of Jesus, such as the Shroud of Turin. What conclusion Yes. did you come to about that? Because that's still a sort of a controversial point.
Oh, it sure is. In fact, I'm confident that Catherine would just as soon I hadn't included that, because this is the kind of thing which people may have been following me along with me, and they say, oh, wait a minute, we're not going to go there, are we?
Yeah.
Well, I will just briefly state what I believe to be the empirical facts about the Shroud of Turin. First is that the fabled, the famous carbon dating of the Shroud of Turin
yes.
was really badly botched. And botched to the extent that the lead author for the original scientific report on the study of the Shroud of Turin has written and done a technical article of documenting the evidence that the piece that was analyzed for carbon dating was not part of the original shroud. And the and by the way, there is another method of dating using the decay of cellulose in the linen of the shroud, which does provide a date to a couple of thousand years ago. But that's not what makes the Shroud of Turin so completely baffling. I don't want to take too long with this, but if you look at the shroud just visually, there's this very faint frontal and dorsal image of a human, and maybe you could make out that it's male, but you can't make out much more than that. In 1898, the first photograph was taken of the shroud, and it revealed, the negative of it revealed an incredibly detailed frontal and dorsal view of a man who had been scourged, had been wearing something on his head that had drawn a lot of blood, that had spike holes in his feet and his wrists, and so forth and so on. Now, the vividness of that image, which you can easily find online, was such that over the years there were attempts to investigate it more scientifically, which culminated in the late 1970s with a team of scientists who came over from the United States, were given access to the shroud, were able to conduct a lot of tests on it. And here's the short story. There is no pigment on the shroud. There's no signs of any paint, no signs of any other artificial coloring. The image is directionless. There is nothing that indicates brush strokes were used. But the really baffling thing, Mark, are that the image is extraordinarily superficial. So that it's not just that the coloring is on the top of a thread. It is on the top fibers of the thread, and it's within each individual fiber, which now we're talking things about a couple of microns thick. It's only in the top micron that there is a color. And so whatever created this didn't penetrate any further than that. Okay, that's a very short... Oh, there are all sorts of other things.
Yes.
There's pollen that they were able to vacuum from the shroud that is located in Palestine and so forth. I won't go into all of that. They are ancillary in my mind to the extraordinary, inexplicable superficiality of the image and its anatomical accuracy. So as I summarize it in the book, if it's proved it was done by a medieval forger, that's going to be pretty much as miraculous as the resurrection itself.
Yes, well, I think, I looked into it myself and came to the same conclusion you did, and I think a lot of people who roll their eyes when you bring up the Shroud of Turin just simply have accepted the common narrative that it is a 13th century forgery or 12th century forgery. They just haven't looked into it as deeply as you did.
It's I'm not talking about breathless popular accounts. I'm talking about technical articles you can access online at a website called shroud.com, and you can get the full text of those articles. Trust me, we're talking about very hardcore science, chemistry and physics in these analyses.
And speaking of science, you mentioned in the book something else. You mentioned that in the early 2000s you had a Road to Damascus moment regarding the Big Bang. Could you talk briefly about that?
Sure. It's a little thin book called Just Six Numbers, and it's written by the former Astronomer Royal of the Britain, Martin Rees, an astrophysicist. And the six numbers refer to parameters of the Big Bang, now that are not explained by theory. In physics, you have theory, which explains a lot of things, and you have what physicists sometimes call brute facts. And a brute fact just is, and that there is no theoretical rationale for it. Well, in the course of the Big Bang, there were all sorts of things that consist of brute facts that appear to have been set in ways which, against all the odds, permitted the development of a universe with stars and planets, as opposed to a universe consisting exclusively of black holes or uniform radiation. The six numbers refer to such things as the ratio of the force binding atoms to the force represented by gravity. And I'm not going to go into any detail about them, except to say in each of these six numbers, and there are another dozen that physicists have identified, the tolerances are extremely small. If that ratio that I just mentioned had been different at the fourth decimal place or more by, a bit, you wouldn't have the universe we had. Taking all those in combination, the Nobel laureate Roger Penrose has calculated that the existence of the universe such as ours is one in trillions, literally. Yes. One in trillions. Now, I think that gives you a choice. The physicists have come up with a novel choice, which is the multiverse theory, that in fact the quantum physics tells us that we could be spinning off innumerable universes. Okay, that depends on string theory and other theoretical justifications that as yet have no empirical foundation whatsoever. But, the theory's very cool. Can I go out, and at this point I'm being a Philistine scientifically, look, I go out and look into the night sky on a cloudless night. I can't make myself buy that there are millions of universes. I just can't make myself buy that. Okay, if I don't do that, and this is the only universe that exists, do I think it's more plausible that we lucked into a one in a trillion chance? Or do I think that it's more plausible that there was an intention behind the universe that, among other things, permitted life to develop? I think that the existence of that intention, which I might as well call God, is more parsimonious, more plausible than believing in a one in trillions chance.
Yes.
And so I said to myself, when I came to that conclusion, I can't believe I'm saying this to myself. But I was. And I still believe it to this day. And that's what opened up for me a completely different understanding of what God's relationship might be to we insignificant human beings.
You write that your journey toward faith has given you a couple of new perspectives on death. Could you tell us one or two of those?
Yeah, the most important is that I've been getting old for a long time and not fearing death. I'm 82 now. So I am fully convinced of my own mortality, which takes a while usually for people to come to terms
with
that. And this was not a case where I realized how much I had changed. Because back in my 40s, and I think into my 50s, I would have those occasional moments of existential dread that I think are very common, where all at once you envision the end of your existence, and it just scares the hell out of you.
Yes.
And depresses the hell out of you. And I had those, but I haven't had those for a very long time now. And I realize it is because, at the very least, I'm not at all convinced that death is the end. And my basis for saying that is grounded in a lot of science. Some of that science involves near-death experiences. Some of it involves other really strange evidence, for example, involving reincarnation, where you have a lot of documentation of children with memories of other lives that have details that can be and have been verified. We're not talking about breathless New Agers recalling being Cleopatra. We're talking about the work of a man named Ian Stevenson and his students who continue that work. And then you have a phenomenon called terminal lucidity.
Yes.
That I just gave a description in the book, but also in a recent Wall Street Journal column, terminal lucidity, where people with advanced dementia, which means that their neuronal circuits permitting life, communication, language, memory, and self-recognition have not been impaired, they have been destroyed, all right? And yet these people come back for a matter of a few minutes or up to an hour or two within a few days of their death, and they recognize a spouse they haven't recognized for years, they recognize their children, they have memories, they have emotions, they ask questions, they exhibit personality characteristics, and then they're gone again. Now, what's that all about? Okay, the combination of these various things make me say, I think consciousness, I'm quite confident that consciousness can exist independently of the brain. And once I admit that, I also have to contemplate the possibility that I have a soul.
And where are you today along the spectrum of belief? Are you in the camp of people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who, at least the last time I checked, is more of a cultural Christian than a full-on believer? Where would you place yourself along the spectrum of belief?
Well, I will interject that Ayaan is a friend of mine, and my understanding is that she also believes that a kind of miracle was worked by Jesus in her life of overcoming some difficulties, some severe problems. And so I don't think she's just a cultural Christian. I think it's deeper than that. As for me, this book is couched entirely in terms of trying to come to grips with the truth value of religion, not its cultural usefulness. Mm-hmm. I think its cultural usefulness is not only important, I think it's indispensable.
Yes.
I think what we are witnessing in Europe is what happens with a very secular society, more secular than any we have seen in history, and I don't think it's telling us an optimistic story about its long-term durability. Okay, so I'm fully on board with the cultural importance,
yes,
not just of religion in general, but of Christianity in particular. But my beliefs, I'm talking only about what I believe at this point as a matter of truth. So I'm among other things, an applied statistician. I have no problem thinking in terms of distributions and probabilities rather than yes, no binary choices. So something like a life after death, I would put as somewhat greater than a 50% probability. What its actual contours might be, how much we have learned about its contours from near-death experiences, I don't know. Something, I think. It's enough of a belief, as I say, that even though I will be very shocked if I go to my physician and I'm told I have 3 months left, I will be shocked and my hands will be shaking and so forth. Yeah, it's not as if I treat death trivially.
Sure.
But I'm not frightened of it. And another thing that's happened is, in ways I have not been fully aware of as they've happened, I think of Jesus differently from any of the other great religious figures. I think of him with a reverence that I do not associate with any of the rest. And I'm as inarticulate as anyone else in saying that I think that trying to describe what Jesus's relationship was with God is beyond our capability. But that, do I think that he is in some sense a living presence in Christianity today, connected in some mysterious way with the historical Jesus of 2,000 years ago? Yes, I believe that's the case too. But in all of these things, I start with the impossibility of anthropomorphizing God, and for that matter, the impossibility of stating precisely in human language a lot of the things we're dealing with.
And for readers who are in the position that you once were as an agnostic, and maybe even atheist as well, what advice would you give them? How would you encourage them to take religion seriously?
I would start with the existence of the universe and the evidence I just talked about, that we're talking about a universe that intends life to exist. I think that if you start with that, you can stick exclusively with what physics has learned, what neuroscience has learned, and come away from that saying, you know what? The Enlightenment went overboard. The Enlightenment taught us that the only legitimate inquiry into the underlying truth of the universe is through reason and empiricism. And in fact, that very empiricism, if you look at it closely enough, is now in the 21st century and throughout most of the 20th century, that empiricism is no longer reducing the things we understand, reducing the things we don't understand. It's providing us with new things that the physicists and the scientists don't understand, for which religion may have answers. And if you can come to, if you look into that closely enough, I'm saying, you are going to walk away understanding that religion is not a bunch of fairy tales that you can dismiss out of hand. That the supernatural not only can exist, but the evidence for its existence at this point is quite strong. And then after that, then you could get into the harder thing of, okay, what do I think of Christianity?
That's good advice, and I will throw in my two cents and say that a great place for agnostics and atheists to begin is by reading your book, Taking Religion Seriously, because I think even for a believer such as myself, it's a great journey. It's a fascinating journey and a courageous one, too, I'll say. Have you faced any professional and maybe even personal ostracism by publishing this?
Well, Steve Pinker has been a genial and companion, a collegial companion, for many years now. And Steve just published a letter to the Wall Street Journal just a couple of days ago, being kind of contemptuously dismissive of my discussion of lucidity, of terminal lucidity. And it's not the Steve Pinker that I have known in the past. When I was writing the book, did I expect that a lot of people like Steve would say, Murray's gone around the bend, he's getting old, he's losing it? Yeah, I had to accept that that was going to happen, and I was not happy with that prospect. So it's early days yet, but I've already, I think my expectation was entirely reasonable, because let's face it, there is nobody as dogmatic as a devout atheist. There is more faith that you have to commit to be a devout atheist than is required by any religion I've ever run across.
Well, again, I'll say it's a courageous book, and so kudos to you for that. And the intensity of your intellectual curiosity of diving deep into all of these issues. And you provide a lot of source work, a lot of sources in there within the book for people to read and to follow up on themselves. It's just really impressive. And like I said, that takes a lot of humility and courage. So congratulations on that. Dr. Murray, how can people keep up with your work, maybe online? Are you much of a social media person?
No, but it's easy. Well, X, yeah, I'm very active on X, all right. But also, I don't have a Substack, but I have all of my past articles, which can be found on the AEI website. If you just type in your browser, AEI Murray, what will come up is my page at AEI, which has an archive of all my everything but my books. And my books are all available on Amazon and so forth. And in the case of this book, I'm told it's out of stock at Amazon. You can order it directly from Encounter Books and also get a 25% discount. So I urge people to do that as well. And use it as a stocking stuffer for all your friends.
Yes, exactly. Good to know. Listeners, I urge you to check out Dr. Murray's work, but definitely get Taking Religion Seriously, even if you're already a believer, as I am, because as I said before, it will take you on a fascinating journey. Charles Murray, thanks for joining us at the Right Take podcast, and please keep up the good work, sir.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.